will work for unemployment data.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Actually, the jobless reports are available to anyone, free even, but you probably don't want to see the continued rise of those without work. The Labor Department said today in the month of June, 467,000 jobs were cut, and the unemployment rate is now at 9.5%. Still, initial and continuing unemployment claims were down last week, signaling there's a slowing of the job losses, right? Let's get analysis now from Bill Stone, Chief Investment Strategist at PNC Wealth Management. He joins us live from Philly this morning. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good morning.
So I know the slowing pace of job losses is tempering that 9.5% jobless number, but I got to tell you, Bill, I'm having a hard time finding a silver lining here. Where is it?
Well, I would agree. You have to look pretty deep to find any silver, but I'll try for you. One is, you know, some portion of that worse than expected decline in non-farm payrolls came from some census workers being let go, which they'll be brought back on again. So that's about 50,000 jobs. But again, as you mentioned, it's tough to find much more than that. I think, you know, probably the best you can hold on to is that maybe the pace of decline in jobs does seem to be slowing.
Yeah, it just seems like we hear that month after month. Where's the stimulus package, Bill? How long till we see any results there?
You know, you'll probably see some. Again, it was because the government jobs showed being down for the month, which, again, kind of shows up as an anomaly. So you're likely to see some gain in government jobs coming in. I think the other side is, you know, speaking of things that the government's involved in, you're likely to see the resumption of vehicle production next month. So some of those people that both showed up in the claim numbers and the non-farm payrolls should be coming back on to work again.
All right, quickly, Bill, you're grilling out this weekend. A friend or a family member asks where the bottom of the recession is. What do you say?
Well, I'm hoping we have a zero GDP growth, so I guess that would be the bottom next quarter, believe it or not.
All right, Bill Stone. Happy 4th to you. Have a great holiday weekend. We do appreciate it. At 9.5%, the U.S. and the Eurozone unemployment rates are exactly the same. In this country, it's a 26-year high. On the continent, it's the worst in a decade. The latest on their report from our man in London, Stephen Beard.
These figures are bad enough, but many economists expect them to get much worse. That's due to what's happening in the Eurozone's largest economy, Germany. So far, the worst effects of the deep recession there have been cushioned. Rather than lay off large numbers of staff, German exporting companies have kept them on, working a shorter week, often with government subsidy. But, says Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform, that's unlikely to last.
We're not going to see a rapid bounce back in world trade and in German exports. Hence, German companies are going to start laying off workers in large numbers over the next 6 months.
And that, he says, will drag the Eurozone unemployment rate much higher. He expects it to hit more than 11% by the end of next year. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Let me see how stocks are reacting to all this. Where's Wall Street? No surprise there. Markets across the board down 2% or more. The S&P down about 2%. NASDAQ 2.25%. The Dow down just about 2% as well. European shares lower right now. The DAX is down 2.5%. And Asian markets ended today mostly down as well. Hitachi today says it'll boost production of its lithium-ion batteries in a deal with General Motors. It plans on upping its output from 40,000 units a month to 3 million batteries a month to help supply GM hybrid cars in 2010. Listening to the Morning Report for Thursday, July 2nd, 2009 at marketplace.org. Online advertisers will announce self-policing guidelines today for how they collect and use data about you and me. The announcement's aimed at heading off tougher federal rules being considered by Congress. Here's Marketplace's Sam Eaton.
The new guidelines address growing privacy concerns over the collection of personal information by tracking people's web browsing habits. The data is sold to advertisers who want to reach a more targeted audience. Starting next year, about 5,000 companies ranging from Google to Procter & Gamble will abide by a set of self-regulatory principles. One big change is that companies will now use ads or web links to alert consumers that they're being tracked. Another requires advertisers to get consent before collecting sensitive information like medical records, prescriptions, and Social Security and bank account numbers. There's also a ban on collecting information about children under the age of 13. The $8.5 billion advertising industry says the guidelines provide transparency. Consumer advocates disagree. They say self-regulation is meaningless, and what's really needed is congressional legislation. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
On paper, it looks like a marriage made in heaven. Banks need a lot of money, and private equity firms have got plenty of cash. But not everyone's overjoyed at the idea of private equity getting involved in banking. Today, the FDIC announces some new rules on how bank buyouts by private equity firms should go. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Private equity firms have already bought at least two banks, and they're hungry for more. Patricia McCoy teaches law at the University of Connecticut. She says some in Washington are worried about that.
One of the concerns about private equity is that it has a short investing horizon, which would focus on short-term profitability. The question is, does short-term profitability come at the expense of long-term health of the bank?
A private equity firm buys a bank with a little of its own capital and a lot of debt. To pay the interest on that debt, McCoy says the bank needs to generate good profits.
Higher profits always come with a price. They imply higher risk.
And taking too much risk got banks into this mess. McCoy says the FDIC will likely tell private equity firms if they buy a bank, they'll have to hold on to it for a minimum period. That should encourage firms to build their banks into solid businesses before selling them on. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The economic ramifications of the military coup in Honduras have been swift. Neighboring countries in Central America have suspended trade, and the World Bank has postponed millions of dollars in loans. But the U.S. has held off on sanctions for now. From the Americas desk at WLRN in Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
President Barack Obama says the overthrow of Honduran President Manuel Zelaya sets a terrible precedent for Latin America. But his administration has not formally labeled it a coup, because that would cut off development aid. Gabriel Torres is a sovereign risk analyst with Moody's Investors Services.
There is a legal procedure by which, if you formally certify it as a coup, then certain amounts of money would be put in jeopardy.
For instance, more than $200 million in funding from the Millennium Challenge aid program. Torres says the U.S. could turn the economic screws further. It could cut off trade to Honduras, or even inhibit the flow of money sent home by Honduran immigrants.
None of that has yet happened. The government of the United States is still trying to work behind the scenes to try to resolve this.
The Organization of American States, with U.S. backing, has given the Honduran military until Saturday to restore Zelaya to power. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Cities across the country are suing online travel companies, claiming the web-based firms are shortchanging them out of tens of millions of dollars in hotel taxes. The stakes are high, especially for cities such as San Antonio and Fort Lauderdale that bank heavily on tourist dollars. Danielle Carson reports.
Say you book a hotel room for $100 on a website like Orbitz or Expedia. You pay the hotel tax on that. But the website pays taxes on a discounted price it negotiated with the hotel, say $80. It pockets the difference between the tax you paid and the tax it paid and considers it a service fee. But some 40 cities don't see it that way.
Governments throughout the United States have been cheated by online travel companies.
That's Stephen Wolins, a lawyer who represents several cities and counties. He says hotel operators are required to pay taxes on the full retail price of the room. And while the online agencies aren't putting mints on the pillows, they're doing everything else.
The online travel company is the only entity completing the entire reservation process. They are charging consumers not only the rate for the room, but the taxes for the room.
But Brian Stagner, a lawyer with Travelocity, says several courts disagree.
Online travel companies simply don't own, operate, or control hotel rooms. Five federal courts out there said that. We're not hotel operators and that we're not liable for local occupancy tax.
The online travel firms are building their defense on another front. Stagner says most hotel tax laws were written before the internet, so localities are, in effect, trying to impose a new tax on web-based companies.
These are Flintstone ordinances that the cities are trying to apply to a Jetson world.
So Los Angeles Times consumer reporter David Lazarus says the solution is rewrite the tax laws.
There are going to have to be some new laws that clearly define that anyone who is selling the room is responsible for the whole nut as opposed to paying taxes simply on the wholesale value of the room. And that's one of the things that's going to have to be addressed here.
For cash-strapped cities, the lawsuits offer a way to make a nice chunk of change. In February, Anaheim, the home of Disneyland, won the first round in a lawsuit which ordered online travel sites to pay $21 million in back taxes for the past 8 years. The websites are challenging that ruling. I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
The Obama administration's tried a number of programs to stem the foreclosure rate. We're hearing about a Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac plan that would allow for refinancing homes with a low loan-to-value ratio of up to 125%. We asked two commentators, Robert Reich and Mark Zandi, about what other actions the government should take. Zandi says loan modifications, but Robert Reich says he's not really into that idea.
Are taxpayers going to bail out all of these underwater homeowners by reducing the principal?
You know, I think taxpayers are going to have to ante up more. I think it's important for people to realize that if we don't solve this problem and bring an end to it, house prices will continue to evaporate, and we will all be a lot less wealthy, and tax revenue is a lot lower. So I think it's a good, it's actually a necessary investment. What do you think? I mean, how can we address this?
I would be in favor of a national moratorium on foreclosures. Several states have tried it with some success. Why not a 6 months the national moratorium on everybody?
When we've tried it, a lot of states, as you pointed out, have tried it, and it didn't really help. In fact, as soon as the moratoriums were off, foreclosures started to surge again. And, you know, you're not solving the underlying problem, and that's rising unemployment and falling housing values. And, you know, I'm not sure that you're going to solve any problems by just delaying the problem.
If you delay it long enough, then housing prices begin to start turning up again. Here's another idea. What about the cram down provision? What about simply allowing people, as they're allowed with their second homes, to declare bankruptcy and to reorganize their finances? After all, big corporations can do it. At the very least, this would give homeowners more bargaining leverage to change the terms of their mortgages, right?
Probably will be other fallout from that. I mean, for example, when people file for bankruptcy, they not only we'll get their mortgage crammed down, but you'd reduce the amount of credit card debt they owe, health care bills, everything else that they have debts on. And it creates other problems for the rest of the financial system that I'm not sure we fully, truly understand the consequences of. But, you know, listening to you talk, you know, it does highlight the complexity of this issue. I don't think there's any other issue that policymakers face that is as difficult as the current housing foreclosure crisis. There's no easy answer to this one.
Well, I'm still going to hold on to a national foreclosure moratorium until you absolutely convince me otherwise. Mark, it's great talking to you.
Okay. It was great. Thank you, Bob.
Mark Zandi is the chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com. Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Tell us what you think at our website, marketplace.org in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great Thursday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.